Good evening. My name is Barbara Nestle, and I'm delighted to welcome you here this evening. A little over a year ago, I lost my husband to a cardiac myopathy. It was very sudden and unexpected and extremely difficult for me to handle. During this time, a good friend, Dr. Henry Curtis from Denver, Colorado, called and said, "Barbara, I'd like you to listen to this tape." Due to the circumstances, it took me quite some time to get around to that. And when I did, I heard a Dr. Joel Wallach say, "Cardiac myopathy is 100% preventable." Well, you can imagine what kind of an effect this had on me. Basically, that's the reason I'm here tonight. It would please me if none of you should ever have to go through the kind of experience that I have had during the last year. Dr. Wallach is not only going to talk to you tonight about cardiac myopathy, he's going to tell you about many other things as well. He's going to talk about a mine in central Utah owned by the T.J. Clark family that's unlike any other on the face of this earth. He'll tell you that what comes from this mine is much more precious than gold and silver. It's good health. I pray that you will listen closely and carefully, because what you're going to hear could very likely save your life and the lives of those you love. Dr. Wallach was nominated for a Nobel Prize in 1991. He's had many other fabulous experiences in his life as well. There's just no way that I can explain to you how happy I am to have him here in Kansas City tonight. So let's now turn the time over to Dr. Joel Wallach. Give him a big hand, please.
Well, I'd like to add my welcome to Barbara's, and I'm certainly glad you're here. How many of you grew up on a farm or still work a farm or have anything to do with livestock? Well, I'll tell you what, you're my kind of people, because I grew up on a farm in West St. Louis County back in the 50s. And we started out with beef calves, and if you raise livestock, the only way you can make money is if you raise a lot of your own feed, for those of you who don't have that experience. And so we raised our own corn, and we raised our own soybeans and our own hay. And we had a truck come out from the mill, and this truck would come out from the mill, and it would grind up the corn and the soybeans and the hay, and then we would add sacks of vitamins, minerals, trace minerals, and we'd make pellets out of it, and this is what we would feed the calves. And in 6 months' time, we'd ship them to market to be slaughtered, or we'd save back some of the best ones for ourselves. We'd knock them in the head and eat them, put it bluntly. And it always fascinated me as a teenager that we did that for those calves, and in 6 months ship them off to be slaughtered, or we'd eat them. And we wanted to live to be 100 years of age without any aches and pains. And guess what? We didn't take any vitamins or minerals. And that bothered me. So I asked my dad, I'd say, "Hey, Pops, how come you do that for those calves and you don't do that for us?" And he'd give me this good old Missouri farm wisdom. He'd say things like, "Shut up, boy. You're getting this farm fresh food, and we hope you appreciate it." And of course, I was very quiet then because I didn't want to miss out on any meals. Well, then when I went to school, I went to the University of Missouri, the School of Agriculture, and I got my degree in agriculture. And it was very interesting to me that I got my major in animal husbandry and nutrition. My minor was in field crops and soils. And then I got into veterinary school. As a freshman veterinary student, I learned the answer to my question. And the answer is this: we know how to prevent and cure diseases in animals with nutrition. And the reason why we do that is because we don't have major medical, we don't have hospitalization, Blue Cross Blue Shield, we don't have Medicare, we don't have Hillary to watch out for us. If you're going to make money as a farmer, you better know how to do stuff yourself, and you better do it efficiently with feed and nutrition if you can. Well, to make a long story short, after I got out of veterinary school, I went to Africa for 2 years, and I was able to fulfill a boyhood dream. I was able to be a Frank Buck for 2 years and work with Marlon Perkins. Many of you will remember him from the Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, and he's a great gentleman. And after 2 years of working with elephants and rhino, people used to ask me, are you a small animal vet or a large animal vet? Well, I would tell them I'm an extra large animal vet because I work with elephants and rhinos. Well, after 2 years, he sent me a telegram and said, "Would you come back to the St. Louis Zoo and work with us? We need a wildlife veterinarian at the zoo for a special project. We were given a $7.5 million grant from the National Institutes of Health, and what we need is a veterinarian who will do autopsies of animals that die of natural causes in the zoo. Well, I was just overjoyed to do that, and so I came back and did that. And of course, I not only did autopsies for animals that died in the St. Louis Zoo, but the Brookfield Zoo in Chicago, the Bronx Zoo in New York, the National Zoo, the LA Zoo, and so forth. And my job, again, was to do autopsies of animals that died of natural causes in the zoo and look for a species of animals that was ultra-sensitive to pollution. This is because during the early 60s, we had just learned about pollution and ecological problems and disasters, and nobody quite knew what to do. And so I was supposed to find a species of animals that was extra-sensitive to this and use them much like we did the canaries in the mine. You know, the old Welsh coal miners used to put a canary in a little wicker cage and take it down in the mine, and if methane gas or carbon monoxide would leak into the mine, the canary would drop off the perch and die first, and the men knew to get out before the mine blew up or they suffocated. Well, again, to make a long story short, over a period of some 12 years, I did 17,500 autopsies on over 454 species of animals and 3,000 human beings who lived in close proximity to zoos. And the thing that I found out was this: every animal and every human being who dies of natural causes dies of a nutritional deficiency. And that fascinated me. It went back, took me back to those calves. I said, gee, that's fascinating. Everybody's dying of nutritional deficiencies. And we could document this at autopsy, both chemically and biochemically and so forth, and things that you saw with the eye at the autopsy table. Well, that fascinated me. And I wrote 75 scientific articles. I wrote 8 multi-author textbooks, and one textbook of my own cost $140 for medical students, and I'm sure the only thing they do is use them for doorstops. And I couldn't get anybody excited. I was on 2020. I was on 1,700 newspapers. I was in magazines, I was in every new network TV that you can think of, and guess what? Couldn't get anybody excited back in the 60s about nutrition. So what I did was went back to school and became a physician. And I finally got a license to kill, and they allowed me to use everything I learned in veterinary school about nutrition in my human patients. And to no surprise to me, it worked. I spent 12 years up in Portland, Oregon in general practice. And it's very fascinating. What I'm going to share with you tonight is what I learned over those 10, 12 years using nutrition with my human patients. And if you take home only 10%, it will save you an enormous amount of unnecessary misery. It will save you a gob of money. And those of you in Missouri know what that means. A gob means a lot. And it will save you, and in fact, it will add on many healthful years to your life. Okay, it'll add many healthful years to your life. Well, you can't do this, you can't get these healthful years, you can't have longevity, you can't live to your genetic potential just falling off a stump. You have to do some things. And the first thing I have to do is convince you that it is worth doing these things. Now, I'm going to start out by convincing you that the genetic potential for human beings is 120 to 140 years, our genetic potential for longevity. Okay, 120 to 140 years. There's no less than 5 cultures whose people live to be 120 to 140. Starts out in the Tibetans in Western China. These people were popularized back in 1934 by James Hilton. He wrote a book called The Lost Horizon. Many of you will remember reading that. It was a Pulitzer Prize winning book way back then. And they did a movie of that in 1937. It's a very long movie, about 3 hours. You can get it from any Blockbuster video. And I would encourage you to get it and look at it when you have 3 hours. It's a great movie. And the oldest living person that has some documentation, I'm sure there's a certain amount of exaggeration in there, but there is some documentation, was a fellow, a Dr. Li, L-I, from China, along this Tibetan border. And this fellow, when he was 150 years old, quote unquote, received a big certificate from the Imperial Chinese government. He was born in 1677, 150 years later, he was given a certificate by the Imperial Chinese government for being 150 years, and then when he got to be 200 years, they sent him another, 50 years later, they sent him another certificate, and supposedly he died at age 256. And as people of that nature, he was written up in the New York Times in 1933 when he died, and the London Times, and so this is fairly well documented. But he may have only been 200 years old. I don't know if he was 256, but this is the person that led James Hilton to write that story. Then there's in 1967 or 68, there was a remake of that movie. It was a color version. If you haven't seen that, it was called Shangri-La. I urge you to see that. Then in eastern Pakistan, there's a group of people called the Hunzas. And these people are very famous for longevity, 120 to 140. If you've been in alternative health for any length of time, you've heard their name at least. Then in what is now Western Russia, it used to be the Soviet Union, the Russian Georgians were made famous during the 70s by Dan and Yogurt. You remember the old Crimea War veterans, they'd get their uniform on, they'd hold a saber up, and they would get a cup of Dan and Yogurt and smile a lot, and you're supposed to make the mental leap that it was the Dan and Yogurt that made them live to be 120. Then just south of them, the Armenians, the Abkhazians, and the Azerbaijanis are famous, at least in the Soviet Union. They were studied for some 60 years because they routinely lived to be 120 to 140. In fact, in 1973, the January issue of the National Geographic, 1973 January National Geographic, did a special article on people who lived to be 100 and are older. And they featured these people. And there's a great pictorial article, you know, National Geographic is very good about coming out with pictures. And three of these dozens of pictures that were in that article, I remember one of them was a lady who was 136 years old. She was sitting in a wicker chair with a big Cuban cigar in one hand and an 8-ounce glass of vodka in the other. And she was partying. She was having a good time. She was not in a nursing home, all slouched over and you know, ready to have somebody take another $2,500 out of her checking account. She was enjoying herself at 136. Then there was a semicircle of couples, boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl, and they were celebrating their 100th and 115th and 120th wedding anniversaries. Then the third picture that I remember is a gentleman who is picking tea leaves up at the Timberline in the Caucasus Mountains in Armenia, and he was listening to one of these little transistor radios back then, and according to his birth records and baptismal records, his military records, and the birth records of his children, the National Geographic said that he was 167 years of age and the oldest living person at that time. Well, in the Western Hemisphere, the Vilcabamba Indians in Ecuador are very famous. They live in the Andes. And then in southeastern Peru, my favorites, the Titicacas, I just like them because I like the name. They're sort of east of the Machu Picchu, the old community. The Titicacas live around Lake Titicaca. And of course, they're very famous for living to be 120 to 140. Well, in May 11th, just about a month ago, the oldest living American at this time and documented through the Guinness World Book of Records was Margaret Skeet. She was from Radford, Virginia. She died at age 115, and she died of nutritional deficiency. You can tell that from her obituary. She died of the complications of a fall. What did she die from? Osteoporosis, very good. She died of a calcium deficiency. She had no heart disease, no cancer, no diabetes, no other infirmities, but she died 3 weeks after a fall because she didn't have enough calcium. Very interesting. Also, her daughter said that she had a craving for sweets until she died, and that's a disease called pica. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but usually when you have a craving for chocolate, if you're a chocoholic or a sugaraholic, that means that you have a deficiency of chromium and vanadium, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Then in a third world country, in Niger, in Africa, a chief by the name of Bauer, at age 126, was eulogized by one of his wives, so I assume it was plural, it had many wives, and she was bragging about him at his death at age 126. He was still in possession of all his own teeth. Okay, so you assume that other faculties are working too. Then, here's a gentleman from Syria, age 133. He died in July of 1993, and he was in the Guinness World Book of Records, not because he was 133, there's been many people who lived longer than that, not because he remarried for the fourth time at age 80, but because he fathered 9 children after the age of 80, and this meant if you add up 9 months for each child, and a year for breastfeeding for each one, and a year between each one of the children, he was still fathering children after age of 100, and that's what got him into the Guinness World Book of Records. So there's still hope for you fellas. Then those of you who like science, in November of 1993, just about 8 months ago or so, those six Biosphereans came out of that dome in Arizona. They were in there for 2 years, three couples, and they were supposed to eat the perfect food and recycle the atmosphere and grow their own food and whatnot and have no pollution in their water or air or food. And when they came out, they were examined by medical gerontologists from UCLA, University of California at Los Angeles, and they put all this information, their physical and their blood work and so forth, into the medical computers at UCLA. And the medical computer said that and projected that they could live to be 165 years old if they continued to do what they were doing. So all of that just says to you that there's a possibility you can live to be 120 to 140. And when I grew up on the farm, we could grow 200 bushels of corn per acre, and with all the labor and all the fertilizer and everything else you did, you could make a profit if you grew 200 bushels per acre. But if you only got 100 bushels per acre and put out that same effort and the same fertilizer cost, you'd lose money. And so I want you to think about it. The average lifespan for an American today is 75.5. The average lifespan for an MD or a doctor is 58. If you want to gain 20 years statistically, just don't go to medical school. Also, if you want to know information about longevity, you're going to be better off asking a bus driver than you are a physician for longevity. Now, there's two basic things you have to do to get there. If you want to live to be 120 to 140, there's only two basic things. They're real simple, two things to remember. Number one, you have to avoid the pitfalls. You have to not step on the landmines, I call it. And those of you in the military, you know what that means. You do something stupid like step on one of those things, you kill yourself wastefully or unnecessarily. And of course, if you play Russian roulette or smoke excessively or drink excessively or wear a black sweatsuit and run down the middle of the highway at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're going to get struck by a car. All of those things are foolhardy, but it's amazing how many tens of thousands of people die in America from doing those stupid things every year. It's amazing. In fact, there's these kids who sat in the middle of the highway because it was done in a movie and whatnot and got killed, the college kids. It's amazing. The last thing I will share with you on that subject of avoiding the landmines, I'd suggest very strongly to you that you avoid going to doctors. Because given half a chance, they will kill you. And I'm going to back up that statement, which is a pretty strong statement, with a statement from Ralph Nader's group in January of 1993. Just about a year and a half ago, January 13th, he put out a news release based on a three-year study on the causes of death in American hospitals, and it was a 1,500-page report, this three-year study, and I'm not going to waste your time or mine by going over the whole thing word for word, but the bottom line says a lot. The bottom line says a lot. And here it is, quote, this is from Ralph Nader now. He's a consumer advocate, for those of you who don't know him, who watches out for us. Quote, 300,000 Americans are killed each year in hospitals alone as a result of medical negligence, unquote. I'm going to read that figure again because it's a huge figure. Quote, 300,000 Americans are killed each year in hospitals alone as a result of medical negligence, unquote. Now, he didn't say slipped away quietly out of neglect in a corner somewhere while they're waiting for an x-ray. He used the word killed. When you use the word killed, that means there was a procedure the doctor was doing went wrong somehow. That means that they gave them a wrong prescription, they put a decimal point in the wrong spot and gave them an incorrect dosage. These people were killed. 300,000. To appreciate how big a figure that is, you have to compare that with our military losses in Vietnam over 10 years, where we lost 56,000 people over 10 years, or an average of only 5,600 a year. On a field of battle where people had guns and artillery and explosives trying to kill each other. And millions of people poured out into the streets and protested that war. We had political anarchy in the last 3 years of the war. Students took over universities and colleges with guns and explosives. National Guardsmen shot students at Kent State in Ohio. We chased the president out of the presidency for 5,600 military personnel a year. And here's one profession that takes your tax money in the form of Medicare and Medicaid, and kills 300,000 of us a year, according to Ralph Nader, and I believe him, he has no axe to grind. And you go out in the street any day of the week in any city, and there isn't even a crazy street preacher out there with a sign that says, protect us from doctors. I want you to think about that, folks. That's number one. You have to avoid stepping on the landmine. So there's a certain value in treating yourself when you can, or preventing disease, so you don't have to get treated. Now, the second thing you have to do, number two, is you have to do the positive things. You have to do the positive things. And I'm going to start out here by just putting a figure up on the board. It's the number 90. And you need 90 nutrients in your diet every day. You need 60 minerals. You need 16 vitamins. You need 12 essential amino acids or protein building blocks, and you need 3 essential fatty acids. You need 90 nutrients in your daily diet, otherwise you're going to get a deficiency disease if you don't have them in complete numbers and optimal amounts. Well, I can tell you that I was one of those nerds back when I was in college. I had a clipboard. We didn't have computers back then. So I had a clipboard, and I was one of those funny guys with glasses and would walk up and down in the student union there in Columbia and say, do you take vitamins and minerals? I was still fascinated by that. And of course, people would kind of look at you crazy and say, well, yeah, I take vitamin E. And I'd wait for them to come up with the other 89, and they didn't. They just, oh, I take vitamin E. Well, today, if you ask people, do you take food supplements? They say, oh, yeah, I take Tums. Because that's what, you know, they hear all the time. Well, again, you need 90 nutrients if you're going to make it. But the newspapers know, and the magazines and TV and radio knows that we're interested in health and longevity and supplements. So they all talk to us, not because the medical profession has asked them to do that in their stead. The medical profession doesn't say, hey, we're so busy saving people with surgery and chemotherapy and radiation and pharmaceuticals, would you please educate the people on nutrition? They do it because it sells newspapers. Well, my favorite article of all time appeared in Time magazine, April 6, 1992. And if you haven't read it, I'd urge you to get it out of a school library or public library and photocopy it. Stick one copy on the door in the bathroom and one on the refrigerator. It's a cover article. It says, the real power of vitamins. New research shows they may help fight cancer, heart disease, and the ravages of aging. Again, there are 6 positive pages in here. There's only one negative sentence. And it was issued by a medical doctor who was asked by the writer of the article, what do you think? What do you think about vitamins and minerals for people as food supplements? And here's what the doctor said, quote, popping vitamins doesn't do you any good, sniffs Dr. Victor Herbert, a professor of medicine at New York City's Mount Sinai Medical School. We get all the vitamins we need in our diets, and taking supplements just gives you expensive urine, unquote. Well, to give you a Missouri translation of that, that means you're just peeing away your dollars if you take vitamins and minerals. You might as well wad up your dollars and throw them in the toilet and flush them away because you're not getting any redeeming value from it. Those quacks are just taking your money for those vitamins and minerals. That's what he was trying to say. It got published. So it must be true, right? Well, I'll tell you what. After having done those 17,500 autopsies and 454 species of animals from around the world and 3,000 humans, and liking to be healthy myself and having children and grandchildren and not too distant future great-grandchildren, I'd rather pee out 50 cents or a dollar a day worth of excess vitamins and minerals. It's pretty cheap insurance. Because if you don't invest in yourself to the tune of a buck a day for vitamins and minerals, guess what? You're going to invest in the lifestyle of an MD somewhere. Because when you pay the medical doctor your fee for going to see him, not one penny of that goes to study how to diagnose or treat or prevent a catastrophic disease in a little child, like who was in here earlier, or how to prevent or diagnose or treat better breast cancer or prostate cancer in adults. Guess what that money goes for? It pays the doctor's mortgage, makes his Mercedes payment. It pays the tuition for his kids to go to medical school at Havitt. You know what Havitt is? Up in Baston. Pays the tuition for his kids to go to law school at Yale. Pays his alimony for his 5 ex-wives. I don't know why doctors always have 5 ex-wives. It must be genetic. You know, they blame everything else on genetics, so it must be genetic. Well, I believe because we've made doctors wealthy, between 1776 and the Second World War, the U.S. government spent $80 million on healthcare and healthcare research and studies. Right now, we're $1.2 trillion a year for healthcare. And it's free. We all know it's free, right? I like that lady. She says, like heck. It's not free, but we're supposed to believe it's free, and everybody wants more of it and more free stuff. Well, I'll tell you what, if you use the human-type medical system for the agricultural industry and the livestock, your hamburger costs $275 a pound. On the other hand, if you use the agricultural health system that we use in animals for humans, your monthly insurance premiums for a family of five would be $10 a month. You take your choice. Well, I believe, since we've made them wealthy through insurance programs and government subsidies, I believe they owe us something. I believe they owe us at least as much as the industries do, according to, for instance, recall notices. This was started, of course, I don't know, 25 years ago when Ralph Nader learned that the Ford Motor Company had made a Pinto car with a rear-end gas tank that would blow up when you got hit from behind at 20 miles an hour, fry everybody in the car. And when people complained to Ford Motor Company, they said, well, you're just dumb for getting in a car accident. We're not going to pay you for that. Well, Ralph Nader says, no, it's a faulty design. So he went to a federal court, and the judge agreed with him, and through a court order, forced Ford Motor Company to send everybody a recall notice with a registered letter, bring that car in, and they'll fix it for nothing. Well, over the years, if you read the business sections of the newspaper, there's always recall notices from one thing or another. Sears had to recall 400,000 major appliances because the timers made in Taiwan would set on fire in the middle of the night. And then there was, I guess, Ford Motor Company again, just a few months ago, they had pickup trucks where the fuel line laid on top of the drive shaft, and after about 25,000 miles, it wore through. I mean, with all these high-priced engineers, you'd think that somebody would spot that little thing. And they had to recall about 25,000 pickup trucks of a certain type. But the one that I think is the funniest, of course, has to do with the Saturn cars. They had to recall every car they ever made from car number one through millions of cars through April of 1993 because the electrical system was somehow coded into TV channel changers. And let's say your neighbor came home at 2 o'clock in the morning and wanted to watch the news or movie because they couldn't sleep. They're there flicking through the channels. Your car would start, drop into gear, and drive out the back of the garage. Well, after a few hundred of them, they believed it was cheaper to send out a recall notice and just get them in and fix them before they had thousands and thousands of suits to rebuild houses. Well, I believe the medical profession owes us that same courtesy, if you will. When research shows that what they've been telling us for 10, 15, 25, 50, 100, or 300 years is incorrect or has been changed, they should send every one of their patients and former patients a registered letter that says, hey, for the next three Tuesday nights, we're going to give you a free one-hour lecture on kidney stones or tuberculosis or heart disease or whatever it may be. Has anybody in this room ever gotten a free recall notice from your physician? Kind of interesting, isn't it? I want you to think about it. What if Sears were to put in 300,000 cars, vinegar instead of oil for an oil change. And the engines in 300 cars for that stupidity would burn up. There would be Senate investigations. There would be class action suits like you wouldn't believe. It ruined my car. But they kill 300,000 a year and nobody protests as long as we get ours free. And that scares me, that attitude. At any rate, I've got a bunch of these recall notices you should have gotten over the last couple of years. We'll go through them quickly. Number one is ulcers. How many of you ever heard that ulcers is caused by stress? Okay, everybody's heard that. If you don't raise your hand, you got Alzheimer's or you're fibbing, right? Well, we knew 50 years ago in the veterinary industry that ulcers, at least in pigs, was caused by a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori. And, of course, we couldn't get one of these high-priced stomach surgeons from Mayo Clinic. In fact, we always used to yell, hold the Mayo, when they say stuff like that. And otherwise, your pork chops would be $275 a pound to pay for that kind of surgery. And we learned that with a trace mineral called bismuth and the tetracycline antibiotic that we could prevent and cure those stomach ulcers in pigs without surgery. And so that's what we did. It cost $5 to cure a pig of stomach ulcers with bismuth, the trace mineral, and tetracycline. Well, the National Institutes of Health now, not the National Enquirer, but the National Institutes of Health came out in February of this year, February 1994, and said ulcers are caused by a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori, not stress. And they can be cured. They actually used the cure word in this news release. Medical researchers never do that. They always say, shows promising results or may be beneficial. They use the cure word, National Institutes of Health, and they say can be cured with a combination of the trace mineral bismuth and tetracycline. Well, for those of you who don't know what bismuth comes in, you can get it from any grocery store or drugstore. It's pink, about $2.95 for an 8-ounce bottle, and it's called Pepto-Bismol. So a teaspoon a day full of Pepto-Bismol and some Oremycin calf scour pellets, you can take care of ulcers. Now you have your choice, whether you're going to treat your own for $5 or go get whittled on. It's your choice. Then what's the number two cause of death in Americans? Terrible disease called cancer, right? Now doctors get information on cancer, you'd think they'd photocopy that, and when they send you that bill, instead of threatening you with collecting, one of these collection agencies, they should send you some photocopies of this stuff. Well, in September of 1993, the National Cancer Institute, not the National Enquirer, but the National Cancer Institute and the Harvard Medical School up in Boston did a study on cancer patients, and they came out and they said an anti-cancer diet was found. I can tell you, when the National Cancer Institute sent that information to your doctor, he leaned back in his chair, wadded it up, and did one of those things, right in the waste can. He's real good at throwing that stuff in there. The only thing he reads is, oh, I get gold golf clubs if I sell 20 prescriptions of Prozac a month. Think about it, folks. Think about it, folks. Well, at any rate, they've picked China to do this study because in one province, Henan province in China, they have the highest rate of cancer in the whole world. They took 29,000 people for 5 years in this study, and what they did was give them different vitamins and minerals at double the recommended daily allowance for Americans. Now, that's a trivial amount. For instance, they used vitamin C for one group, and of course the RDA, recommended daily allowance for vitamin C, is 60 milligrams. Double that's going to be 120 milligrams. You can't go into a health food store and find a vitamin C tablet or capsule for less than 500 milligrams for an adult. And of course, Linus Pauling, the gentleman with two Nobel Prizes, says if you want to prevent and treat cancer with vitamin C, you got to use 10,000 milligrams a day. Well, all the doctors who used to argue with him back 35 years ago are all dead. And today, Linus Pauling's still 94, and he works 14 hours a day, 7 days a week on his ranch in the Big Sur in California and teaches at the University of California, San Francisco. So you have to make up your choice whether you're going to listen to the dead doctors or Linus Pauling. Your choice. Okay, vitamin C, double the RDA, nothing happened. Vitamin A, double the RDA, nothing happened. Zinc, riboflavin, the trace mineral molybdenum, niacin, nothing happened. In one group, they got a major benefit. In this group, they got three nutrients at one time. They got vitamin E, they got beta carotene, and the trace mineral selenium. Those three were at double the RDA. And if you get a 0.5% benefit in any nutritional or pharmaceutical experiment, you've made a major improvement in humanity's life. And so these articles get published. So I want you to remember that statistic. 0.5% is major benefit. Well, in this group that received the vitamin E, beta carotene, and selenium for 5 years, deaths from all causes were reduced by 9%. Almost 10 out of every 100 or 1 out of every 10 who were going to die in that 5 years from any cause survived. Then cancers, all cancers, 13% survived who would have died without those three nutrients. 13 out of 100 lived who would have died. And then the type of cancer that was most prevalent in Henan province, stomach and esophageal cancer, 21% lived who would have died. 21 out of 100 lived. Now to me, those are significant numbers, and your physician for the number two cause of death in America should have sent every one of you a photocopy of that, at least giving you the information. Even if he didn't want to give you the advice, give you the information, let you make up your own mind. Well, here's one I think is funny on one hand, and on the other side, it tells you the attitude of physicians. This has to do with arthritis. It was in September 24th, 1993 that it was released. Again, it was from the Harvard Medical School and the Boston VA Hospital. How many of you in here have ever been to a VA hospital? Anybody in this room? Okay, good. Well, you know the people who've been to a VA hospital, you have two opportunities to give your life for your country. One's on the field of battle, and the other's in the VA hospital, right? Well, at any rate, the title of the release was Chicken Protein Halts the Swelling and Pain of Arthritis in a Patient Trial. And what they did, they took people who failed to respond in any way to medical treatment for arthritis. These people got gold shots, methotrexate, they got aspirin, prednisone, cortisone, everything else you can think of, physical therapy. And the only thing left for them was joint replacement surgery. Okay, now before Harvard Medical School of the VA hospital was going to give it to them, they said, look, we're looking for some people who are willing to suffer for 90 more days, just 3 months, because we want to try something, a short-term experiment, and they got 20 volunteers. And what they did for those 29 volunteers who failed to respond in any way to medical treatment for arthritis was they gave them a heaping teaspoonful of ground-up dried chicken cartilage in their orange juice every morning. Just a heaping teaspoon of ground-up chicken cartilage. And in 10 days, according to Harvard Medical School, all the pain and inflammation was gone. These are people who didn't respond in any way to medical treatment. In 30 days, they could open up a new pickle jar that had never been opened. And in 90 days, 3 months, they had maximum return of function. Now, here's the funny part. The funny part comes by a statement of the guy who was the director of that study from Harvard Medical School, and here's what he said. Quote, listen to the words, they're very important. Quote, after 3 months, it was clear that the drug was beneficial, unquote. Because it worked, chicken cartilage had become a drug. You can see he's thinking about patent numbers, and his eyes are rolling around with $300 a capsule, 20 patients, and you can just see him calculating, right? That means if you go to Kentucky Fried Chicken and you buy a bucket of chicken, throw away the skin and the meat, and eat the ends off the bones, you're practicing medicine without a license. And if you go to a Kentucky Fried Chicken in the middle of the night, in the dark of the night, and you go to their dumpster and you root through there and you collect 2 5-gallon feed buckets full of chicken bones, and you take them home with a hammer and you pound off the ends of those bones and dry your own cartilage in the microwave, you know, you're manufacturing a pharmaceutical, and the FDA is going to put you in jail. Well, if that's a little messy for you, and you don't want to pay those lawyer fees, you can go into any grocery store and get some Knox gelatin. Women know about Knox gelatin because it's good for your fingernails and your hair and your skin. It has the raw materials for chicken cartilage, has the raw material for your cartilage. It's made out of beef cartilage and beef tendon. And if you take 2 of those little half-ounce envelopes a day in your orange juice, and you take it with 1 ounce per 100 pounds of body weight of colloidal minerals, next time I come by here in 3 months, you're going to run up on this stage and hug me and kiss me if you got arthritis. How many of you ever heard of Alzheimer's disease? Everybody's heard about it today. 50 years ago, when I was a little kid, there was no such thing as Alzheimer's disease. It's a new disease, one of those things that just sort of happened. Now it's a major disease. 1 out of every 2 people who reach age 70 get Alzheimer's disease. Pretty scary. Well, we learned 50 years ago in the animal industry how to prevent and cure in the early stages Alzheimer's disease in livestock. Can you imagine how much a farmer would lose if the pigs were all laying there scratching their heads saying, why am I here? Where is the feed box? Because if they're not gaining a couple of pounds a day, you're losing money, right? So we learned in the agricultural industry how to prevent in the early stages cure Alzheimer's disease. We do it with high doses of vitamin E and low intakes of vegetable oil. You say, Wallach, that's crazy. High doses of vitamin E. Well, you should have got a recall notice from your doctor in July of 1992 because the University of California, I mean, we're talking about a sophisticated research medical school here. University of California, San Diego came out and said, vitamin E eases memory loss in Alzheimer's victims. Now, they're only 50 years behind on that from veterinary medicine, so it might be safer going to a veterinarian. Then how many of you in this room ever had a kidney stone? Anybody in here ever get that kidney stone? Okay, I see a few in here. What's the first thing a doctor told you to give up nutritionally when you got your kidney stone? Give up calcium. No dairy. No dairy. None of those vitamin mineral things with calcium in them, because they have the stupid, naive, ignorant belief. That's pretty intense. They have the stupid, ignorant, naive belief that the calcium in your kidney stone comes from the calcium you eat, when in fact it comes from your own bones when you have a raging calcium deficiency, a raging osteoporosis, then you get kidney stones. We learned 1,000 years ago in writing in the agricultural industry, if you wanted to prevent kidney stones in livestock, you better give them more calcium. You better give them more magnesium and more boron. Now the reason is, of course, bulls and rams, male cattle and sheep, have special anatomy. When they get a kidney stone, they die. They call it water belly. They die. When you and I get a kidney stone, we just wish we were dead. But no farmer's dumb enough to pay for the feed for an animal and have it die before you can either eat it or send it to market. So we learned how to prevent those things. Well, you should have got a recall notice from your doctor, especially you people who've had kidney stones. Your urologist should have sent a notice to you. This was about 15 months ago, March of 1993. It says, calcium limits kidney stone risk, and this is from the Harvard Medical School up in Boston, by the way. In a study that turns conventional medical wisdom on its head, researchers have found that people whose diets are rich in calcium run a reduced risk of developing kidney stones. In a study of more than 45,000 people who were ranked into 5 categories, the group that had the most calcium had no kidney stones. So it took them 1,000 years to catch up. Now, about 5 years ago, when I started out on this crusade and started lecturing to people all across America, and I'm in one time zone and the next and all over, I knew I was going to get crazy out there doing this. Last year, I was on the road 300 days out of the year, 300 out of 365 days. And so I decided I needed to have a hobby that I could take with me. Every time I get a little wacko, I could go in my room and do this hobby, and I'd be okay. You know, it'd be kind of like having a little piece of home with me wherever I went. And I wanted to have a hobby that would help other people. I didn't want to collect baseball cards because I like football. And I didn't want to do just crossword puzzles because good mental exercise, but wouldn't help anybody else. And I couldn't take my compost pile. I like to garden, and the hotels don't like that, you know. So I decided I was going to collect obituaries of doctors and lawyers. Now, as crazy as that sounds, remember I told you the doctors live to an average age of 58, and we live to 75.5, and here's a group of people, professionals, who pontificate to you and tell you, well, this is what you need to do. You need to give up salt and no caffeine, and you need to not eat butter and eat margarine and do all these crazy things. And they die at age 58 on the average. And of course, all those people who live to be 120 to 140, they put a chunk of rock salt in their tea every day, and they drink 40 cups of tea a day, 40 chunks of rock salt, and they cook with butter instead of olive oil, and they live to be 120. So who are you going to believe, the people who live to be 58 or the people who live to be 120? It's your choice. Anyway, I got a few of them here, some of my favorites. So this Dr. Stuart Cartwright, age 38, he dropped dead in his home. He was a family practitioner of a ruptured aneurysm. That's a ballooning of an artery that's a weakened artery because of the fragmenting or the brittle condition of the elastic fibers and arteries. Just like when you hit a chuck hole with your car tire and you break the cords in there and you get a balloon. He dropped dead like he was poleaxed, okay, right in his home from a ruptured aortic aneurysm. Now we learned in 1957, that he died of something that even a turkey wouldn't die from. And the reason why we say that is, 1957, we learned that aneurysms are caused by a copper deficiency. We had a pilot project, 250,000 turkeys, and we made complete food pellets where you put all the 90 nutrients in there, and in the first 13 weeks, fully half of those turkeys died. 125,000 of them. Farmers were out there every morning picking them up by the bushel basket. They took them to the state diagnostic labs and their autopsy, and they found out that they all had died from a ruptured aortic aneurysm. So they doubled the amount of copper in there, and the next year they tried to raise 500,000 turkeys, and they didn't lose a single turkey from a ruptured aortic aneurysm. And they ran that experiment in mice and rats and rabbits and dogs and cats and calves and sheep and pigs and whatnot, and guess what? They found out there's a whole series of diseases that are caused by a copper deficiency. Gray hair is the first sign. You start getting gray hair regardless of your age, you got a copper deficiency. You get skin wrinkles because the elastic fibers in your skin are going. Those little crow's feet around your eyes and facial and body skin wrinkles. You look like you're a little prune drying up. Okay. Then, of course, there's the varicose veins. Varicose veins. That's caused by an elastic fiber breakdown. Then, of course, parts of your body begin to sag. Under your arms, your breasts, your bellies, your legs, all this stuff starts sagging. And you can go to a cosmetic surgeon or plastic surgeon if you want, but it's a lot cheaper and a lot more effective and a lot safer if you just take some copper. Okay, well, Dr. Cartwright may have had a medical degree, but he didn't have expensive urine, so he died of something that even a turkey wouldn't die from. Then here's one. This fellow, he was a doctor's doctor, Dr. Martin Carter. He almost made it. He died at age 57. He got his medical degree from Harvard Medical School and his PhD in medicine from Yale. Of course, he was autopsied by the best because he was a doctor's doctor. He said, quote, "The cause of death was a ruptured aortic aneurysm," said Dr. Jules Hirsch of the Rockefeller University Hospital, unquote. What did he die from? Copper deficiency. See, he didn't have expensive urine either. Then here's an attorney. I know you guys, you're not a doctor, are you, sir? Here's an attorney. She was so famous, she was from Detroit, age 44, Ellen Joyce Alter. She was in the New York Times obituary. She made the big time. And of course, she probably had steel buns because she belonged to one of those private health clubs. All these gals want steel buns, you know, doing their little exercises. But she didn't have expensive urine because she died of a ruptured cerebral aneurysm. When they don't do an autopsy, the symptoms could be called a stroke or subdural hemorrhage, but very frequently they're caused by a ruptured aneurysm, which is a copper deficiency. She didn't have expensive urine. How many of you here have ever heard of a guy by the name of Stuart Berger? Stuart Berger, he wrote 5 best-selling books on health and diets and nutrition. He got his medical degree from Tufts Medical School, which is a very fine medical school in Boston, not too far away from Harvard Medical School. And the books he wrote included The Southampton Diet for Weight Loss. He wrote Forever Young, 20 Years Younger in 20 Weeks, and How to Be Your Own Nutritionist. And he died at age 40. How'd you like to follow his dietary practices? He died at age 40 of cardiomyopathy, which is a selenium deficiency. The same cause as white muscle disease or stiff lamb disease. And any farmer can go to a feed store and get selenium pellets or selenium injections, things like Celiptoc and Bosi and so forth. And Dr. Stuart Berger, a guy who wrote 5 best-selling books on nutrition, died of a nutritional deficiency. He didn't have expensive urine. Now, you can totally prevent cardiomyopathy for 10 cents a day. And if we don't do it, we're malignant dumb, I like to call it. You're malignant dumb if you don't take in 10 cents a day worth of selenium. It's a waste of your life. That's one of those landmines you can avoid. The medical treatment of choice for cardiomyopathy is a heart transplant. It costs $750,000. I want you to think about that. They get the heart free from a donor. They get the blood free for the surgery from the relatives. They use $2.50 worth of suture material. And they charge us $750,000 for that procedure. Now, 6 months ago in LA, when they had the earthquake, they were putting people in jail for 60 and 90 days for price gouging, for selling these terrified people a gallon of water for $4. They put them in jail for price gouging, for selling them a gallon of water for $4. Now, to me, that's entrepreneurialism. You know, that's being in business for yourself. If you had a way to distill water and make water, and you had a car and you could get in there and sell those people a gallon of water for $4, hey, more power to you. Because if you go to a 7-Eleven and buy a quart of Evian water, it's $1.29. So 4 of those quarts is $5. Kind of interesting, isn't it? They said it's price gouging because those people were terrified. Well, talk about a person who needs a new heart. They're terrified. $750,000, we should put those doctors in jail. But we bow to them because, oh, that's high-tech medicine. Out of 270 million people in America, you save about 50 a year. Is that cost-effective? I don't think so. I don't think so. At any rate, Dr. Stuart Berger didn't have expensive urine. And here's the last one, and many of you may know this woman. Her name was Dr. Gail Clark. She was age 47. She was the chief cardiologist of the West St. Louis County Group of Hospitals. She was the chief cardiologist for the St. Mary's Hospital, St. Mary's Health Center in Richmond Heights in St. Louis County. She was age 47. Guess what she died from? Heart attack, a cardiomyopathy heart attack. You can just see her walking down the hall. She's got the stethoscope around her neck. You know, this is her little status symbol. Got my stethoscope around my neck. Back when I was in school, they folded it up very bravely and put it in their pocket. Boom! She falls down. She has a heart attack right in the hall. And, of course, the nurses scoop her up and put her on a gurney, and they call the technicians and another doctor. Code 3, code blue, whatever it is. And they whip her into the room. And you can hear them. Let's say you're a cardiac patient. You're laying there. You're all hooked up to the monitors and the IVs. And you hear them say, okay, tear her clothes off. Okay, stand back. Didn't work. Turn it up. Stand back. And then you hear that terrible sound when you know that the treatment didn't work. The flat line when you know the heart is gone. And everybody walks out of the room dejected, and you say, nurse, what happened next door? And she says, well, your cardiologist, you know, the chief cardiologist of this hospital, age 47, Dr. Gail Clark, just died of a cardiomyopathy heart attack. But you can see all the patients, they're holding their gowns. And they're running out of that hospital, leaving their watches and their shoes and their checkbooks and everything and their plastic credit cards because they don't want to get what Dr. Gail Clark got.